I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Tal Kanan, IDF pilot, entrepreneur, fund manager, philanthropist, and author of God is in the Crowd, 21st Century Judaism. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinshiniot, Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport, and Ron Benicote. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sameach, a very happy holiday of Passover. Today is the second day of Pesach, the week-long festival of freedom and matzah, although there are certainly some Jews who believe Passover begins and ends with the Seder, the evening of Passover. For Reform Jews and all Jews in Israel, Passover actually, certainly technically, lasts for 7 full days. For conservative and Orthodox Jews outside of Israel, Pesach actually lasts 8 full days, which means more opportunities to eat that bread of no leaven, that flat baked dough of intestinal affliction, you know, matzah. During this springtime Passover Festival of Freedom, we Jews are commanded not to eat anything leavened, including, of course, bread, but that means more matzah for everybody. And as anyone who's ever listened to Jewish at this time of year knows, your host, that's me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is not a fan of matzah. Before I say more about matzah, you must know that I love most Jewish foods. This Pesach, for example, I made chicken soup and matzah balls from scratch with my son Boaz, enough to serve 15 or so people at our second night Seder. Made a successful raisin apple apricot cinnamon kugel, and so far, nobody has died yet from my cooking. Charoset, in all its many variations, is a personal specialty of my limited culinary skills, mostly because you don't have to cook anything. This year, I actually made about 220 Moroccan date nut apricot raisin charoset balls for our incredible 108-person-strong Seder at Congregation Beit Simcha. In the non-Passover sphere, Hamantaschen and latkes compete on my palate for the title of all-time favorite Jewish food. A great challah is a true taste of heaven, and I even enjoy gefilte fish. While Sephardic and Oriental Jewish specialties, with their liberal use of spices and rose water and other flavors of the East, are among the all-time Jewish delicacies I love. In fact, there are few Jewish foods I don't enjoy when well-made. Ah, but matzah? Matzah is the signal exception. My one area of personal aversion, the Jewish food I find both painful and nearly inedible, is the one food we must eat in profusion this time of year, that ever-popular rendition of baked perforated cardboard, matzah, the bread of affliction. When the Israelites were given the choice between personal and religious freedom and eating only unleavened bread, or staying in slavery, that must have been a pretty tough choice. I'm not sure I wouldn't have chosen slavery and decent bread. I will receive criticism and emails professing shock that I can't stand matzah. How can I call myself a rabbi? And matzah with butter and salt is fabulous. Look, anything with butter and salt tastes pretty good, including newspaper and shirt cardboard, which matzah, of course, closely resembles. I mean, the French cook snails with butter and salt and claim that they are edible. We Jews just do the same thing with matzah. Perhaps my favorite Passover joke is, what do you call someone who derives pleasure from the bread of affliction? A matzachist. Anyway, I annually complain so much about matzah before, during, and after Pesach that I've actually gotten into trouble over my anti-matzah bias. Manischewitz will not return my calls asking them to become sponsors of Too Jewish. Streitz filed a complaint with the FCC alleging religious food bias. I have been banned from posting by the Matzah support group chat room. After much public criticism, Facebook is now looking into allegations that my anti-matzah advocacy was sponsored by Vladimir Putin as part of a Russian government anti-Semitic plot. Bowing to this unleavened pressure, I have to back off on my distaste for the tasteless bread of culinary affliction, or face a report from a special prosecutor as filtered by the Attorney General. And so, to avoid this impending witch hunt, and as a bow to all those matzah advocates everywhere, and to play us in on this second morning of Pesach, here's a little more Passover music, one of my favorite takes on just what matzah really is like. It's from a past guest of Too Jewish, the Smooth E, Eric Schwartz.
I feel like a freak, cause every time I pull out something to eat, but it's weak, I can't do this, cause I'm Jewish, and I can't eat bread. Yeah, my rabbi said only matzah.
Any way you wanna eat it, cold or hot, it's matzah. Fun for your mother, brother, sister, father, matzah. Buy in bulk for a lower cost per box, it's matzah, 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 matzah. Hanukkah, no, that's over, so you don't get passed over, get your over to my pad is Passover. I'm the mad flow, a smoothie demon with the jibbin jabbin. If you want the story of Passover, rent the Ten Commandments, starring Charlton Heston. But I got a question about the bread that is unleavened, causing indigestion. Call matzah. Eat it for a week, we got stuff. No bread, no pasta. Best believe a Jew is stopped up. Now Moses made the matzah when he was fleeing Egypt. Had no time for bread to rise, he said, I just leave it. We can eat it like this, feed it to the Hebrews. But little did he know that the weight would end up equal. Cause
let my people go.
Make the anthem, get your damn hands up. Maybe it will help you pass some. How could one bread rock is so famous when the taste is the same flavor of the box it came in?
Matzah.
Eat it at once, ain't no second guessing.
Matzah.
Leaving crumbs on my lap and chest, and it's called
matzah.
I found the apicomin in my small intestine.
Matzah, 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 matzah.
That was Eric Schwartz talking about matzah on Passover, which we are commanded to eat on this festival of unleavened bread. Enjoy it, even if I surely don't. Our guest this morning, who is enjoyable, is Tal Kanaan, who has an extraordinary biography, an IDF pilot, successful entrepreneur, fund manager, philanthropist, and now the author of the new book, God is in the Crowd, 21st Century Judaism. Meet Tal Kanaan when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Tal Kanaan is the author of a new book, God is in the Crowd, 21st Century Judaism. His background is, well, fascinating and different, and I'll let him tell you about that. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
So you grew up essentially secular Jewish in Florida. Tell us about your peregrinations towards where you've come to now.
Well, yeah, I would say typically American Jewish, in that Judaism was more or less a box we ticked under religion on a form that we'd have to fill out. Not much more than that. I have three older brothers, all of whom married non-Jewish women and have non-Jewish families. So we also shake out more or less according to the statistics on American Judaism. And I discovered Judaism in boarding school in New Hampshire, believe it or not, through a Calvinist minister. And I think my original approach to Judaism was probably the wrong one, in that my Judaism was very much defined by anti-Semitism. That was my reason for being Jewish. It isn't today, but that was, I think, my original path into Judaism.
So you were at an exclusive boarding school and kind of came into contact with your Judaism, which eventually led you to Israel and the Air Force. Tell us a little bit about that process.
Right, so not a traditional path for Odin, but
it's not bar mitzvah, and then I went to camp, and then I joined Hillel. It's not quite the path most people might take.
So I had a sort of defining moment in high school when I saw the picture of the boy in the Warsaw Ghetto with his hands up, kind of an iconic picture from the war. And what struck me in that picture was actually not the interplay between the boy and the Nazi soldiers, but the boy's parents and family, which if you look at the picture, they're on the left side of the picture. And what resonated for me, what actually really angered me, was the look of shock on their faces. And what struck me as the abrogation of their most basic duty, which is the protection of this child, it struck me that Jews should have a plan B. And here, this is what it looks like when Jews
don't have a plan B.
Are complacent. And it didn't take me long to realize, what's my plan B? I've never really conceived of myself as anything but an American. Jewish was a completely arbitrary modifier for me. It didn't mean much in my life. What's different here? And that question, which I still haven't, I think answered fully. I would, if I had to answer, I'd say I think America actually is an aberration in Jewish history. This is truly a Jewish home, but I can't say that for sure. Just as my ancestors in Germany couldn't have said that for sure about Germany. And when I first went to Israel on a kind of a teen tour and looked around and saw people with the courage not only to ask that question but to answer it with their feet. Here they were, having reclaimed sovereignty and reestablished dignity. I think that's really what sort of lit it up for me. Jewish dignity. They were willing to pay a price for their freedom, and it was a high price, but they paid it, eyes wide open. That was very stirring to me, and kind of a long story short, I found my way to Israel in college. Made a decision when I was there. Let's say in retrospect, maybe a bit of an impetuous decision. Didn't really understand what I was getting into from an Israeli perspective and from a Jewish perspective. I was really quite ignorant of what both of those definitions might be. And through a very kind of unlikely series of events, found myself at the Air Force Academy. I was drafted, like everybody. Found myself at the Air Force Academy, actually graduated, and it's a very focused experience. The academy, and then life in the squadron after the academy, extremely focused, and doesn't leave you much time for for hobbies. And I never really got a chance to re-examine, or frankly even examine, exactly what is the ideal that I'm serving here. I don't think, yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm going to say that it's an incredible story from Exeter Academy to the Israeli Air Force, a little college in between. We'll pick up the story when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish with Tal Kanon, author of God is in the Crowd. Congregation Beit Simcha, House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, is celebrating its first services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in the foothills in northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to all throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 3001 East Skyline Boulevard on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell, just across from La Encantada. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us Friday night at Skyline and Campbell for Shabbat Passover services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah study is at 9 a.m. and Shabbat services are at 10 a.m. weekly. This week, we'll hold Yisker Memorial Services on Saturday morning at 10. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school, Torah Tikes program, rich array of adult education academy courses, high school programming, all of that, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675 or BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona and the fastest growing congregation at its exciting beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And Chag Sameach, happy Passover.
Thank you, and to you, and
so,
yours.
When I lived in Israel, I spent the middle of Passover on my very first full trip to Turkey, which is still one of my favorite and most interesting countries, one of yours, one we've spoken about a lot. There was a huge election, a kind of a, I don't know, we would call it a midterm election, mayoral election. And it looks like there may be a sea change in Erdogan's long tenure as the new Ataturk.
Right. Well, so a few comments. First of all, the relationship between Turkey and Israel is fraught, but it's very important. They do a lot of business. A lot of Israeli tourists go to Turkey, particularly the resorts on the south coast, because it's barely 90 minutes by air,
yeah,
and they can gamble. And the food is similar because the famous Israeli breakfast, so-called, is actually an Ottoman breakfast.
Ottoman Empire breakfast, okay.
So the two countries have naturally close ties. Istanbul, at least, still has a sizable and influential Jewish community. A lot of big businesses and whatever are run by Jews. And the relationship has had its ups and downs, especially under Erdogan, who sort of promotes de facto, I mean, you can call it anti-Semitism or anti-Israel positions, or curries favor with the Arab world to an unprecedented degree. I mean, most Turks have a knee-jerk aversion to Arabs and look down on them. They actually ruled over the Arab world for at least 500 years and are not used to treating the Arabs as equal partners, and certainly bothered by the fact that some Arabs today are much richer partners than the Turkish half of that relationship. That being said, we know that Erdogan is sort of a strong man. His electoral base is largely in rural areas, but it was also in Istanbul, where he's from.
He's and which the mayor, is mayor of Istanbul,
yeah,
was his first big position.
The biggest city in the country.
So these
mayoral elections that just took place were a major upset to Erdogan. They were cause for jubilation among many Turks, but clearly Erdogan and his party lost Ankara. They conceded that early on in the electoral count. Istanbul was much closer. I think the difference was something like 25,000 votes or whatever.
In a city of many millions.
In a city of 15 or 18 million, that's a small margin. One reason that it was even possible for the opposition to maybe win is that they were better organized this time than they have been in previous elections. And they actually slept on sacks of votes so that the votes couldn't be tampered with. And this election, particularly in Istanbul, was therefore pretty clean. And, you know, a recount may be warranted, but it may come up with the same result. And Erdogan appears to respect the electoral process enough that if the recount shows that he lost, he'll accept the loss. It's a huge slap in the face, and we should probably talk next week about what it means for Turkey and what it means for the region.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. This week, for you, a Pesach classic. A blind man sits on a park bench during Pesach. The rabbi sits next to him, takes out his lunch, including, of course, some Passover matzah. Seeing the blind man has nothing to eat, taking pity on him, the rabbi takes a piece of matzah, gives it to the blind man. A couple of moments later, the blind man turns, taps the rabbi on the shoulder, and asks, "Who wrote this garbage?" You see, matzah is bumpy and it like braille and... Anyway, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benakot, representatives of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
So it's Pesach, and that means in America that you have a Seder, and if you're at a Jewish day school, you maybe have the week of Pesach off. But if you're not, then you have to bring matzah sandwiches to lunch every day. And it's not so great. But in Israel, it's a totally different experience, right?
We have like 2.5 weeks off. But even after those 2.5 weeks off, people still bring matzah sandwiches to school.
Because they got leftovers.
Yes. And because like it's good.
Or you baked a lot of matzah with your family.
So exactly. So it's a really fun time, especially because... Passover in Israel, that time, it's kind of warm, like weather-wise, you know, it's kind of warm
perfect
outside.
Weather,
exactly.
Always.
Exactly. So, and you have a long break, so you always, like, all my memories are from that time, are memories of me with my friends, you know, hanging out, going to the beach, walking around, family. There's a lot of family involved in it because our parents get time off from work, most of them, not all.
For Pesach, right?
Yes. So it's a really fun time.
And then, of course, the Seders, you have big groups, but you probably have people over, like, the whole week, right? And you go to people's houses.
It's
Yeah, you see your family a lot in Pesach all the time.
So it's good if you like your family.
Of course, yeah. because everyone's off, and it's a great chance to be with everyone. There's a lot of, like, celebrations in Pesach. There's, like, the first holiday, the second holiday. There's the Mimuna. So everyone...
The Mimuna at the end, the really fun end of Pesach, where you eat all kinds of delicious Moroccan foods.
Yes. So you see your family a lot, and it's a really great experience because you don't get to see them a lot, like, in the...
Regular year. Yeah. So, in a way, Pesach for you guys is a little tough because you've spent... That was the time when you had your most time with your family, probably almost the whole year, right?
Yeah. I mean... Like, when you have time off, you know, we have a lot of holidays off, and mm-hmm. both our families, but not always everyone get the whole time off.
Sure.
So sometimes you're just like off, you're going
to... Somebody's got to work sometime.
Exactly. But Passover is really like family and traditional and all about being with your family and your friends and the people that you love. So I just really remember it as a really fun time. To hang out with your family and your cousins and everyone. It's really fun.
Well, I hope your Pesach here is, if not as full of family, at least full of other people's families and a lot of joy here, even in the United States. I have to say, for me, the two most beautiful times of year in Israel are Pesach and Sukkot, because the weather's perfect and people are off of work and it's just a great time. It really reminds you like how holidays can bring us together.
Exactly. It's
great
amazing.
Holidays both.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
And you can have my leftover matzah. If you
I will come and take it.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
And now a word of Torah. This coming Shabbat, we encounter a bit of conflict over Torah portions. If you're a conservative or Orthodox Jew outside of the land of Israel, including Arizona, you'll be celebrating the eighth day of Passover, the extra day required in the diaspora, and have a special festival reading for Pesach. If you are a Reform Jew or live in the land of Israel, you'll read the Torah portion of Achrei Mod from Leviticus. These two cycles rejoin in a couple of weeks, but for now we're reading different Torah portions. More Torah for everybody, in a way. For those of us reading the Passover portions, this week's includes the seventh-day reading of prose and poetic accounts of the crossing of the Sea of Reeds in Beshalach, including the Song of Moses at the sea, and commandments for how to observe the Passover in biblical times in Deuteronomy. Both reinforce the essential message of this great holiday. We are to remember that we were slaves, the lowest members of any society, and God brought us out of Egyptian servitude with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. This message lies at the heart of all Judaism. It is repeated not only on the holiday of Pesach, Passover, but every single Shabbat of the year, when we declare in the Kiddush that even the Sabbath itself is a remembrance of the Exodus from Egypt. Why would any people work so hard to remember that our ancestors were penniless slaves? Most nations pride themselves on their ancient greatness, not their humble origin. Yet we Jews are enjoined repeatedly to remember that we are almost literally nothing, that we are descended from nobodies. In a way, it is the likely source of the great Jewish compassion for the poor and downtrodden, our constant identification with those who have little or nothing, our practice of giving tzedakah, charitable gifts, constantly to improve the justice of this world. It is also why the vast majority of American Jews and Jews everywhere identify with the migrants, the immigrants, the border crossers. For had God not freed us from slavery and led us through the wilderness to the promised land, we too would have had to flee persecution and slip across borders in the hope of finding asylum. And from the time of the destruction of the first temple 2,600 years ago, we often were wandering Jews, expelled from one country after another. These messages were relevant 3,200 years ago, and they seem at least as relevant today, as does the central message of our Seders the last couple of nights. In every generation, each of us is required to see ourselves as though we personally had come out of Egypt. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Tal Kanon, will explain what he means by the wisdom of the crowd where the Jewish future is concerned, and what he sees ahead for our people. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In the conclusion to a stunning political reversal in Israel, Israeli Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked announced that she will now take a break from politics. Shaked, who joined with Education Minister Naftali Bennett in forming the New Right Party, was supposed to broaden the appeal to right-wing voters in Israel, has announced her withdrawal during a pre-Pesach reception at the Justice Ministry. "I'm leaving for my own personal liberty for a period I cannot put a time limit on," Shaked said. The New Right Party fell 1,400 votes under the electoral threshold of 3.25% of voters in the April 9th national Israeli election. It did not win any seats in the new Knesset. This was a particularly startling fall from power for Naftali Bennett, who formed and led the Jewish Home Party to 12 seats in Knesset as recently as 2013, and has been Minister of Diaspora Affairs, Minister of Education, as well as Minister of Economy and Religious Services in the government. Bennett is a multimillionaire entrepreneur and was seemingly one of the key players in government in recent years. Ayelet Shaked was a rising star of the right, and both were expected and expecting to play important roles in Netanyahu's next administration. But Shaked and Bennett conceded defeat last week after demanding and receiving a recount, which changed nothing. Shaked said last week she is optimistic about Israel's future, and we accept the will of the voters and are moving on. In response to recent outbreaks of measles among ultra-Orthodox communities in New York, 500 doctors who serve Jewish communities across America have signed on to a letter calling on all children and healthy adults to be vaccinated. "We, the undersigned doctors who faithfully serve the Orthodox Jewish communities of North America, strongly urge all members of our community to receive all recommended vaccinations," the letter reads. It is signed by doctors from 14 states, including New York, New Jersey, California, Florida, Texas, and even Arizona. It calls on Jewish communities to work together to prevent harmful diseases from spreading. We are aware of the dangerous misinformation campaign being spread and reject any unproven, unscientific statements that contradict all available current science-based studies on vaccinations. The letter is being featured in a mass information campaign to the Jewish community about vaccinating, the Yeshiva World News has reported. The majority of Orthodox Jewish children do get vaccinated, and there is no religious reason not to do so. Prominent rabbis in New York have now called on all of their followers to vaccinate their children, but recent false rumors that the vaccine uses some non-kosher preservatives have led some Haredim, ultra-Orthodox Jews, to avoid vaccinating their children. The U.S. confirmed 555 measles cases already in 2019. That's 50% higher than the total number for 2018. The majority of the cases are centered in New York City and its large Haredi Orthodox community. And just when you think the position of the ultra-Orthodox in Israel on conversion to Judaism cannot get any more insane, a case comes along that proves that there are no limits to craziness. Last week, the Tel Aviv Rabbinical Court rejected the Jewish status of the son of an American woman who converted to Judaism through recognized Orthodox rabbis several decades ago, and whose conversion was approved by the Beit Din of America in 2018. According to the written decision of the court, the ruling was made following an opinion submitted to it by Rabbi Asher Ehrentreu, a senior official of the Jewish Status Clarification Unit of the Rabbinical Courts Administration in Israel. The latest decision comes despite criteria published by the chief rabbinate in November 2018, just last November, for recognizing diaspora rabbinical courts, as well as the publication of an explicit list of rabbinical courts that are currently recognized by the Rabbanut, the chief rabbinate. That includes the Beit Din of America, the court in question. Making the situation even more Kafkaesque is the fact that a sister of the man in question was married through the chief rabbinate several years ago, without questions raised about her Jewish status. This man and his children will likely face the revocation of their Jewish status should the case not be otherwise resolved. A request to appeal the decision by the Itim Religious Services Organization was rejected by the Supreme Rabbinical Court, the Rabbanut. Itim has appealed to the president of the Supreme Rabbinical Court, the Rabbanut, Chief Rabbi David Lau, to intervene in the case and grant its request for appeal. Lau has yet to respond. There are at least two other cases in which Orthodox conversions approved by U.S. rabbinical courts that have formally been listed by the chief rabbinate as recognized for the purposes of conversion have nonetheless been rejected by the Rabbinical Courts Administration. Itim Director Rabbi Seth Farber accused the chief rabbinate of violating Jewish law and normative Orthodox Judaism. The latest case involves the son of a woman who converted to Judaism through an Orthodox rabbinical court in the U.S. in the 1970s. The family made Aliyah to Israel many years ago. The man recently got engaged, submitted a request to be registered for marriage through the rabbinate in Tel Aviv in 2018. Because his mother is a convert to Judaism, the case was sent to the Tel Aviv Rabbinical Court for a Jewish status investigation. January 3, 2019, Rabbi Shlomo Shtesman, head of the three-man panel in the Tel Aviv court, ruled the rabbinical court that had converted Shimon's mother was not recognized by the chief rabbinate in the rabbinical court's administration. The mother's Jewish status and that of her son were therefore rejected. His request to register for marriage, Jewish marriage, was denied. Shtesman wrote that the updated and unambiguous opinion of Rabbi Asher Ehrentreu of the Department for Jewish Status Clarification, the Rabbinical Courts Administration, determined the court that had converted Shimon's mother was not recognized, and the court was therefore forced to reject the request. All the rabbis who presided over Shimon's mother's conversion to Judaism in the 70s are now dead. The issue of recognition of Orthodox rabbinical courts in the diaspora for Jewish status has become increasingly thorny. There are numerous cases in which conversions performed by prominent and respected Orthodox rabbis have been rejected by the Rabbanut, the rabbinical courts in Israel. Before November, the reasons for these rejections were unclear because it was undefined and there was very little clear criteria for recognition of diaspora rabbinical courts. The publication of the criteria and the list of recognized courts supposedly resolved the problem, but the chief rabbinate and the Rabbinical Courts Administration are not adhering to their own lists. The Rabbinical Courts Administration admitted as much in its response. The list of recognized rabbinical courts are recommendations only, do not receive automatic validity without further inspection and testimony, as is required when dealing with personal status issues, that is, whether someone is a Jew. The lists themselves change and are not permanent in accordance with new and updated information about the trustworthiness of the converting rabbis. He added the name of the converting rabbi in this case has not been on the lists for 2 years. Wow. Well, the rabbi who converted the man's mother in this case has been dead for 28 years. He is not likely to appear on a list of rabbis and rabbinical courts currently recognized for conversion. No other reason was given for denying the man's Jewish status. Rabbi Farber says the current situation is totally unacceptable. The chief rabbinate is ignoring its own criteria and standards and harming converts to Judaism and their children. For years, the office of the chief rabbi refused to acknowledge which rabbinical courts it recognized. Now it is ignoring the very list of recognized rabbinical courts it produced, confusing everyone. This is an intolerable situation, which the state rabbinate is discriminating against converts, disregarding its own standards, violating Jewish law, and defying normative orthodoxy. In more positive news, a team of Israeli scientists 3D printed a heart with a patient's own cells in a world first. Past researchers have been able to print simple tissues without blood vessels, but this Israeli development was the first time in history anyone anywhere has successfully engineered and printed an entire heart replete with cells, blood vessels, ventricles, and chambers, Tal Devir of Tel Aviv University said. Devir and his team reported their findings last week in the peer-reviewed journal Advanced Science. The heart, about the size of a rabbit's, is too small for a human, but the process used to create it shows the potential for one day being able to 3D print patches and potentially full transplants. Because the heart is made from the patient's own biological material, it reduces any chance the transplant would fail. The team used fatty tissues, then separated and reprogrammed the cellular and acellular materials. Stem cells that became heart cells were then created. Amazing. Development is a major breakthrough in medicine and could help battle heart disease, leading cause of death in the U.S. Patients will no longer have to wait for transplants or take medications to prevent their rejection, Tel Aviv University said. Instead, the needed organs will be printed, fully personalized for every patient. However, the medical research is a long way off from being able to transplant 3D-printed hearts into humans. Devir said the heart the team printed needs another month before cells mature enough to beat and contract. Tests on animals have to be conducted. It would also take a whole day and billions rather than millions of cells to print a human heart. But Israeli researchers remain hopeful. Perhaps in 10 years there will be organ printers in the finest hospitals around the world, and these procedures will be conducted routinely. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Tal Kanon is the author of God is in the Crowd, 21st Century Judaism, His Own Path to Jewish Identity, and exploring what Jewish identity means today. We began to trace at the start of the show. It's fascinating, from Exeter to college and then to immigration to Israel, the Air Force Academy, life in a squadron. Catch us up a little bit after that. You said it was a very focused experience in Judaism and, of course, in Israel. So what changed after that?
Yeah, I spent many years so engaged in that professional pursuit, which has, you know, obviously very high stakes. You can't really afford to lose focus. And it was only toward the end of my active service, which was 8 years, that I had a chance to step back and ask some very important questions. And it was actually a moment of crisis for me. And I think it's probably where this book starts. I started keeping a journal at that time to sort of, you know, try to parse through the various thoughts and emotions I was having at the time. In that this had started as a sort of a Teach for America moment or Peace Corps moment. Something was kind of a college adventure. I was, you know, full of idealism and zeal when I went off to do this. But unlike Teach for America, it's not something that I could just reverse course and say, okay, I'm finished with this. I'm going to move on to something else now, because I'd already taken action that bore irreversible consequences. This is not Teach for America. This is a deadly endeavor. And the 1990s was a very active period. I suppose there are very few inactive periods in the Middle East. And I relate some of that in the book because I think it actually ends up being a fundamental Jewish question, which is what price should we be willing to pay for Jewish sovereignty, Jewish freedom, Jewish dignity? And I have come to the conclusion that we should be willing to pay a high price for it, but it's got to be configured in a way that serves most Jews. And it's not that today. But if we, I relate a story, and it's one of a number of incidents. But what does it look like from the inside when something morally reprehensible happens in combat? It's very easy today to judge from a distance, and I think Israel does get judged quite harshly and very unfairly. But what does it look like when you take action with very honorable, very human intentions, but because of your own human weaknesses, because of the complexity of the mission, because of the nature of the war itself, and frankly because of your adversary's policies, you make a mistake that ends up resulting in terrible, terrible consequences, in this case for civilians. And I actually dwell on that a bit in the book, because it's important that people understand exactly what type of pressures people are under when they're making these decisions, what leads to these sorts of mistakes, and maybe most importantly, what are the consequences on the individual afterwards, which all drives this question. What is it for? What exactly is the idea we're serving?
So you have an interesting concept of what makes Judaism, what's made it vital and allowed it to survive, which is this idea of the wisdom of the crowd. Explain that, if you would.
So I think the first thing you need to ask is, how is it possible that there's a coherent identity called Jew, considering that about 2,000 years ago, this people was dispersed across the globe? It had been governed pretty much like any other people up until that point, under a hierarchy, a sovereign hierarchy that was attached to a piece of territory, Israel, but then was dispersed by the Roman Empire throughout the world, hundreds of nodes of Jewish life around the world, not coordinated with each other. In fact, in most cases, for most of the next 1,800 years, they didn't even know about each other, or most nodes didn't know about most other nodes. Right? There was definitely no contact between them. A very complex orthodoxy that was to evolve dramatically. Right? It was already complex at the time of the dispersion, and it became much more complex over the coming centuries. No pope, no central organizer to officiate that or adjudicate the course of that evolution. How is it that there is a coherent identity 1,800 years later called Jew? I definitely would have bet against that at the time had I been there. So I argued that there's actually been a governance structure in place. It's a very non-traditional governance structure. I think it is uniquely Jewish. And it has to do with this area of statistics called the wisdom of crowds, which I think is most easily explained described. I think a lot of people have seen this before. If you go to a fair, you often see a contest where you've got to guess the number of jelly beans in a big jar. And the interesting thing about those games is not that there are certain, there are people who are very good at guessing the number of jelly beans in a jar. It turns out that is a skill that some people have. And many people really do not have it. The interesting thing is not who's good at it. The interesting thing is that if you have enough people participating and under the right conditions, which I can lay out, the simple average of everybody's guess is typically better than the best guess in the entire group, which should be shocking, but you can repeat it over and over. And the term was coined by Francis Galton, In fact, it's worth reading his article in Nature from 1907. But I think it's challenging to put it better than Francis Galton does. And among the conditions of crowd wisdom are everybody needs to be answering the same question. We should have independence of input. You and I should not compare notes before we make our guesses. We should do it independently. It's great if we're diverse. That's very helpful. So if you are a great jelly bean counter and I'm a lousy jelly bean counter, it's good that we're in this together. In fact, we'll get a better result than if we have all great jelly bean counters. It's another counterintuitive notion. And we need some aggregation mechanism to cull all of our inputs. And in this case, a simple average works very well, but there are a lot of different types of aggregation mechanisms that could apply here. Those conditions, I think, applied to Judaism for about 1900 years, from around the time of the dispersion until today, where we were all focused on the same set of questions, which were codified in Mishnah and later Gemara, in Talmud, which is really a large set of questions that we grapple with and debate. So we are all answering the same set of questions. We answer them differently, but that's great. The Romans helped us with independence and diversity just by separating us. And then through a series of expulsions, hundreds of small expulsions, dozens of large expulsions, divergent traditions or divergent answers to those questions had to be reconciled. And again, without any global authority officiating over that reconciliation. So, you know, I point to kind of small questions. Do we do legumes on Passover or do we not? There are two separate traditions here, which are gradually over many generations being reconciled. And then there are large questions. For example, who is a Jew or what is Judaism? Same. We have a lot of different answers to those questions, and we're in this constant process of reconciliation.
Well, it's a kind of organic process, isn't it? It's a little bit like I don't know. You use a variety of analogies. I'm thinking it's almost like a Wikipedia experience. People keep adding to, and although who exactly is editing it isn't clear.
I think that's exactly right. And maybe I like that you said that people keep adding to it, because, and I think here is the heart of the issue today and the challenge it's facing Judaism. We can't stop adding. We cannot stop adding to that process. If Judaism becomes static, it will end. It has to continue evolving in order to exist. In fact, this process of evolution is very much at the heart to me. It's very much at the heart of the definition of Judaism, and we have created certain structures, or maybe created is too strong a word. We
evolved maybe certain structures.
Yeah, or I was going to say stumbled.
Stumbled upon.
into certain structures that are really hampering our ability to continue to innovate and reinvent ourselves, and that's something that we need to examine, and that's really the core of the book.
What are those structures that are hampering our ability to continue to evolve and change and develop?
Most broadly, the United States of America and Israel, where one of the things that I think we need to recognize today is that the word diaspora is no longer a useful model for describing the physical architecture of Judaism. 90% of world Jewry is in the United States and Israel. And the trend is toward the 100, not toward the 80, right? We are increasingly concentrating in these two jurisdictions. And I argue in the book, and I understand that this is not a universally accepted point, but I argue that these are two jurisdictions that are devoid of anti-Semitism in any way that affects the practical life of most Jews. This is not Europe. It's not the Middle East. This is truly an aberration in Jewish history, where we are truly, and by the way, I think that hasn't always been true, but I think it's true as of my generation, right? I grew up in the 70s in this country. We are truly American. Judaism is a choice now. And on the one hand, that's a great thing in that we can, I think, define ourselves in a way that we haven't had the power to define ourselves in 2,000 years. On the other hand, anti-Semitism has been such a critical part of our definition. This goes back to my initial Judaism, which was very much defined by people who hate us. Anti-Semitism has also been a convenient mold into which we could grow. It is definitely one of the drivers of our kind of coherence as an identity. So the challenge today is create a Judaism that will be relevant and meaningful enough that a critical mass of Jews, and for that matter, people who wish to become Jews, which we could talk about separately, will embrace by choice, which will be, to me, a beautiful and exciting project, or accept the real possibility of the end of this civilization, the end of Jewish civilization, in two or three generations. I think that's really what we have. In the United States, we have largely lost sight of the common set of questions, is that we've bred Jewish ignorance into successive generations of Jews. I'm a very good example of that. In Israel, we've lost the aggregation mechanism, in that we don't have to duke it out, you and me across the table debating points of Jewish definition. We have inadvertently nominated two popes of Judaism, the two chief rabbis of Israel, as the formal adjudicators, and we've also endowed them with the teeth of the sovereign. Right, they can actually affect our lives, whether we agree with them, support them or not. They have real sway over the life of every Jew in the world. That's something that we have to challenge. I think we have to end that. That's not a structure that we can preserve. We need a new one.
We'll have to figure out what that new one is by reading your book and continuing to discuss it, because we're running out of time. I should have mentioned Talkanon is also an entrepreneur, co-founder of Clarity Capital, chairman of Karet Israel Economic Development Funds, largest nonprofit lender in Israel, and a diverse and fascinating guy. Where can people go to find out more about you and more about the book?
Amazon.
The place for everything today.
Yeah. What are you going to do?
The Talmud of the world. Tal, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Two Jewish. Our guest will be Denise Shader-Smith, mother of the late Mallory Smith, author of Salt in My Soul, the moving autobiography of a young Jewish athlete who died of cystic fibrosis. It's an amazing story. Don't miss it. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TwoJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from our most ridiculous Passover composition ever, past guest Sean Altman's They Tried to Kill Us, We Survived, Let's Eat. Don't learn your Pesach or Jewish history from this song, but enjoy its preposterous and very funny spin on the holiday of freedom and matzah. My friends, may you have a Chag Pesach, Sameach v'Kasher, a Zisin Pesach, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. The year was 1492. Hitler had just invaded Poland. Madonna had just become a Jew. Moses was found on the Potomac. Then he marched with Martin Luther King. He came back to free us from our bondage, 'cause S&M has never been our thing. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. They tried to kill us, we were faster on our feet. So they chase us to the border, there's a parting of the water. Tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. Then the Pharaoh, who looked like Yul Brynner, heard the Jews were trying to escape. Charlton Heston came right down from the mountain. He said, Pharaoh, you're a damn dirty ape. The
menorah was almost out of oil. Farrakhan was planning Kristallnacht. The gefilte was nearing extinction. It looked like Moses and his flock were verkocht. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. They tried to kill us, we were faster on our feet. But we knew how to resist, cause we've read in Schindler's List. Tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat.
The 10 Egyptian plagues. Blood. Locusts. Boils.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.